You're listening to Beyond the Headlines, a production of the International Peace Institute, an independent think tank dedicated to the prevention and settlement of conflict. Coming up, author Vali Nasser, senior advisor to the U.S. Special Representative for Afghanistan and Pakistan, talks about his new book, Forces of Fortune, The Rise of the New Muslim Middle Class and What It Will Mean for Our World. A surprising work that may change the way you think about the Middle East. Enjoy the program.
Good evening. I'm Warren Hoag, the Vice President for External Relations of IPI, and I'm delighted to welcome you here for this evening's Beyond the Headlines event with Vali Nasser, author of Forces of Fortune, The Rise of the New Muslim Middle Class, and What It Will Mean for Our World. In a review published this past Sunday, the New York Times called the book outstanding and credited Vali with brilliantly narrating the histories of the middle class in parts of the Muslim world like Iran and Pakistan. Now, in addition to being a celebrated author, Vali, as your invitation indicates, is also a professor at Tufts University and senior advisor to Richard L. Holbrooke, U.S. Special Representative for Afghanistan and Pakistan. In the Great Blue Mosque in Turkey, there is a phrase in flowing script etched into the arch over its main exit. The words ascribed to the prophet say, "A merchant is the beloved of God." Turkey is one of the models for Vali and the argument he is making in the book about the transformative power of markets and commerce. Turkey is a state with a democratic government, a robust economy, a substantial middle class, thriving trade and political relations with other countries, and a vocation for engaging with the world economy. And there are other countries in the Muslim world with some similar attributes that Vali examines in this book about the virtues of a middle-class commercial revolution. Among them are Indonesia, Malaysia, Bahrain, other Gulf states, and the Emirate of Dubai. It is time, he says, that we take a good look at the vitality of the energetic blending of Islamic piety and capitalist fervor that is flourishing in many pockets around the region. Now, a secular middle class has been at the forefront of recent transitions to capitalism and more representative government in China, in India, and across East Asia, across Latin America, and Eastern Europe. Only in the Middle East has a sizable middle class, friendly to Western values and eager for political freedom, failed to take root. The book is rich in historical detail about the evolution of Muslim society since the time of the Crusaders and the importance of people like Mustafa Kemal Ataturk in Turkey and Reza Shah Pahlavi in Iran. It includes an affecting anecdote about how Reza Shah gathered a group of students together in 1928 and lectured them on their national responsibilities as they went off to study in Europe. One of those students was Vali's grandfather. The book focuses at the outset on a critical, more recent time in which the Muslim world changed dramatically, that 32-month period that separated the Ayatollah Khomeini's return to Iran in February 1979 and the assassination of Anwar Sadat in Cairo in October 1981. During that brief time, an Islamic revolution seized Iran, Pakistan proclaimed itself an Islamic state, the Soviet Union touched off a jihad by invading Afghanistan, and Egyptian President Anwar Sadat was assassinated by radical fundamentalists. Vali notes that this moment in history provoked a deepening of conservative Islamic attitudes and anti-Americanism across a wide swath of countries from North Africa to Southeast Asia, and a rise in extremism that ended up birthing Al-Qaeda. In its sharp reaction to these events, Vali fears the U.S. and the West risk reducing everything in the Middle East to a fight against fundamentalism and seeing every expression of Islam as a threat. His book wants us to direct our attentions elsewhere. We should concentrate, he says, on the 1 billion Islamic consumers spread, as he describes it, across a vast expanse from Morocco to Malaysia, with notable toeholds from Detroit to Dusseldorf, from Sao Paulo to Singapore. We entitled this evening's talk, Transforming the Understanding of the Muslim World, because Valley asserts throughout his book that Westerners suffer from an oversimplified view of the many things in Muslim society that deeply disturb them. He names them and attempts to detoxify them. Islamic finance, Sharia law, jihad, madrasas, and fundamentalism itself, which Valley argues is not necessarily at odds with modernity. He also takes up secularism, something prescribed by many in the West, and shows how it has failed in the Middle East. Valley, we're all ears. Thanks for coming up here from Washington to talk to us, and the floor is all yours.
Thank you very much. First of all, it's a great pleasure being here at this institution, and I'm very grateful to Warren for having invited me to talk about my book and the direction that I think that we ought to be thinking about the Muslim world. It's often quite a challenge to try to nudge public opinion to step back and think about Islam and the Muslim world differently. Every time we try to do that, there is yet another suicide bomber or a terrorist attack, and it almost seems like we're back at square one, at least in terms of our discussion. It goes without saying that extremism, particularly since the events of 9/11, has been quite transformative in the way in which the West thinks about the Muslim world, the phobias that it has about an Islamic challenge, and the frustration about its inability to either make sense about why the Muslim world appears to it the way it does, and how to get it to move past where it is. But there's also a danger in the obsession, near obsession, that exists with this issue, whether it's deserved or not, in that we often lose sight of the larger picture of why we are where we are and whether there is anything else happening that we ought to be thinking about. If we were back in 1979, before that 32-month started, before the Iranian Revolution happened, if you go to the library today and look at books written on the Muslim world or on the Middle East, you will literally find no reference to Islam that is of political significance. It didn't exist. It didn't exist until it happened, which means that we often don't see what's coming over the horizon, being focused on what is right in front of us. And I do think that there are trends in the Muslim world that are critical. Some are very negative, and some are positive. It is important for us to look at and to put in perspective. Now, the other issue is that often when we think about the Muslim world, it's become almost a habit that we talk about moderates versus extremists and how to find the moderates, how to empower the moderates, how to make extremists more moderate. And there are all kinds of prescriptions out there. We think of the necessity for a grand debate that, you know, we should sit down the extremists and find the moderates and have one reason the other one. And it's a debate that can be won intellectually and culturally. We also are constantly looking in our own mind for a great reformer. It's sort of for an Islamic Luther, as we often say, who's going to essentially Protestantize Islam, break the hold of tradition, and bring Islam into modernity. But I think all of these issues are worthy of thinking about, although I think sometimes in thinking about the Muslim world and trying to find parallels with the Western world, I think we're looking at the wrong picture. If today we were to think about who is a Luther in the Muslim world, it's probably Osama bin Laden and Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, who are anti-clerical, who are the ones who are breaking with tradition, who are talking about every man to his own Quran, the way early Protestants broke the power of the church. If we thought about early history of Protestantism in the West, Calvin's Geneva or John Knox's Scotland was pretty much like the Taliban's Kabul, a puritanical, rigid, intolerant place with severe punishments for the slightest deviation from the practice of true faith. But the West, which we imagine as prosperous, liberal, open, driven by capitalism and democracy, was not the product of religious reform, was the product of industrial revolution and a capitalist revolution. And, you know, looking around the Muslim world for a very long time, particularly after 9/11, what struck me, one of the most important facts about the Muslim world was not just that it had a prevalence of piety and extremism in it. That may very well be. I'm not going to contest that. But I think another very important fact to me was that its large parts of it are outside of the global economy in a meaningful way. It's the largest single part of the world that is not part of globalization. If we thought about the two most important global trends of the past two decades, one is economic globalization, the other is the rise of extremism. And there is a very clear correlation to that. The more the places in the Muslim world which is more outside of the global economy, you have more rigidity of ideas and extremism. And where you have the greatest amount of integration into the global economy, which is not in many places, you have a lot more hopeful signs and hopeful trends and even breakthroughs. So, I mean, the fundamental fact is, much as it was the case in Europe, cultural change doesn't come before other changes. It's other changes that bring about cultural change. So the West went from rigid Protestantism to democracy and prosperity. Scotland went from being a seat of very rigid Protestant ideas to being the inventor of modernity, to seat of industrial revolution, the place that produced people like David Hume and Adam Smith, not because of religious reform, but because of a commercial revolution, because of trade, because of economic prosperity. Which to me says that when we think about the Muslim world, one of the most fundamental issues is, going back to a sort of an American political dictum, is the economy stupid? Now, at some level, I think we understand that because we make a correlation often between poverty and extremism. We assume that it's frustration caused by lack of opportunity in country after country that breeds extremism, that people who don't have any hope or are suffering or are poor are lured to easy solutions that are produced by fundamentalists and extremists. And probably there is a lot of evidence to support that in many places. And if we thought of it that way, the picture in the Muslim world is actually not rosy. You have in country after country, the overwhelming majority of the population or a plurality of the population are youth, which means that they are in their 20s and below. In some countries, sometimes upwards of 60% of the population would be in their teens. And therefore, you have a sort of a huge demographic bulge that the economies cannot sustain. The Arab Development Report said that by 2015, the Arab world has to produce 110 million new jobs in order to catch up with the demand that is being generated by the demographic boom. So we often understand that there is this correlation between poverty, frustration, and extremism. But the issues that I thought is important is a little bit more than this idea that injustice breeds extremism. I think the key is that if you looked at the Muslim world, it is not just that it has too many poor people, too much lower class. It is that it has too little middle class, and the right kind of middle class. In other words, the transformative class in the history of the West, and if you looked at modern cases in Latin America, in Eastern Europe, in East Asia, in India today, in China, it is a middle class. It's a middle class that is connected to trade, that is connected to the global economy, that its financial interests are tied to market forces. And it is not the product of governments, it's product of the market. It is responsible for economic transformation of its societies, and it's the main force that brings about cultural and political transformation. If we looked at large parts of the middle class, that class has been missing. There is a middle class. There was a middle class in Iran in 1979. There was a middle class, if you went to many Arab countries in the Gulf, et cetera, you find a middle class. But that's not the kind of middle class that we see in China or in Brazil or in India. This is a middle class that was created top-down from the time of Reza Shah Pahlavi in Iran or Mustafa Kemal Ataturk in Turkey. It's a middle class that is produced top-down that depends on government for salaries or for business contract or for its sustenance. It's not the generator of wealth. It is not. Economies in most countries does not depend on the wealth that is produced by this class. So as a result, it doesn't play the same role that the Chinese or the Indian or the Latin American middle class is playing. Now, there is sign of hope. In other words, there are places around the Muslim world which this middle class has been emerging. And where it has been emerging, and although I must say it's still fairly small, and the global economic downturn has not been good for it. But where it has emerged, the results are positive. In other words, we've seen the right kind of movement in terms of cultural change, attitudes towards society, attitudes towards politics, towards the economy, towards globalization taking place, which says a number of things to us which are critical. One is that if given an opportunity, Muslims are capable of behaving like everybody else does. In other words, often when we debate about Islam, we're caught between two arguments. We want them to follow the laws of history as they were laid down by the West. But often in the same breath, we say they are incapable of it. So we often argue both ways, that because of their faith, they cannot get on the rail tracks of history. That's the only way in which they could be members of the global community. But the evidence from countries like Turkey, Indonesia, Malaysia, even Dubai, and even pockets in the Arab world, Iran and Pakistan, is that when you have this middle class emerging, it begins to behave in similar ways as middle classes everywhere else. Now, let me first begin by saying, who do we mean by middle class? Middle class, economists define it very basically as exactly the middle of society, not too rich, not too poor. At least people who have formal income, have formal jobs, have formal income, and if you put aside the money they spend on food and housing and stables, they have a third of their disposable income left to spend on anything else. And then, you go from there up, so middle class upwards. Some also have definitions of modernity attached to it. In other words, middle class are those who also have accepted certain values about smaller family, investing in family, issues relating to women, education of children, etc. But regardless of how we pick it, numbers vary. But when we look, even if you looked at fuzzy numbers, you have about 10 to 15% on average in the Muslim world would fall into the category of the middle class. Now, the way I thought about this, the numbers are not easy to come by. It's difficult to sort of pinpoint where this class begins and where it ends. It's much easier to look at its impact and its footprint. And if we looked at places like, for instance, Dubai or Turkey, both the impact and the contours of this class become clearer. Now, I know these days it's not fashionable talking about Dubai. After a few front page articles about the collapse of its real estate market and its impact on Wall Street, I often hear people saying that Dubai is over. What's the point of referring to Dubai? I was not impressed. I'm not talking about Dubai as if suggesting to people that they should move their money there.